Good morning, 7:42 here on the Mighty 690 as we go throughout a Wednesday edition of the program. And it is time, as we do every Wednesday, to talk with the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. And joining us here on the line, we have Jesse Gilmore, a horticulture agent. Good morning, Jesse. How you doing?
Morning, James. Doing pretty good here on this end of the district. Feeling a little under the weather today, so that's why I'm calling in instead of being there in person, unfortunately. Hey. But it is kind of getting to that point in the year where you can expect a little bit of a flu season, so hopefully I don't have the flu.
I know that is it's a unfortunate. Yeah, I know there is stuff going around, but we're glad that you took the time to call either way. So good to talk to you here. And I know you wanted to talk a little bit in this first segment about soil acidification, right?
Yeah. So this is especially if you are wanting to fertilize lawns and tall fescue, the time to be fertilizing your lawn. Usually for fertilizing like vegetable gardens, you'd be doing that in the spring. But almost every time that I get a soil sample, the pH is high. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about soil pH, soil chemistry, and the ways that you can adjust the pH to be more amenable to the plants that you're trying to grow. So pH is, we're going to run through a little bit of not terribly heavy chemistry, but it is going to get a little technical. pH is just a measurement of the balance of hydrogen ions and hydroxide ions in the soil. So hydrogen ions are positively charged. The more hydrogen ions you have, the more acidic your soil is going to be. And hydroxide ions, which are OH, they are negatively charged. The more hydroxide ions you have, the more basic your soil is going to be, the more alkaline. pH runs from on a scale from 0 to 14, with 7 being exactly neutral. If your pH is 7, there is and it's not always going to be perfectly balanced, but there is going to be a very, very close balance of hydrogen ions to hydroxide ions. When you combine hydrogen ions and hydroxide ions, you get water. So that is what 7 is. Most plants are going to want a pH in your soil between 6 and 7, so slightly acidic to neutral. Once you start getting too high or too low below that for most plants, you're going to start seeing some growth issues. In acidic soils, you're going to start seeing some root health issues in most plants, and in alkaline soils, you're going to start seeing micronutrient deficiencies. Now, because our parent material or the rock that soil weathers off from is limestone, limestone is calcium carbonate. And so when it weathers, you end up with a lot of hydroxide ions in the soil naturally. So we are naturally a very alkaline, not very alkaline, but moderately alkaline soil. So think somewhere around a pH of 7.5. Most plants are going to be able to tolerate that slight increase, but the thing to remember about the pH scale is that it's logarithmic. So a pH of 8 is going to have 10 times more hydroxide ions in the soil than a pH of 7, and 100 times more hydroxide ions in the soil than a pH of 6. So you've got your soil test, ideally, that's telling you what your pH is, and you find that you need to acidify the soil or bring the pH down to a more reasonable level. Sometimes that'll be because you are experiencing micronutrient deficiencies. At high soil pH, you're going to be seeing iron and magnesium problems more than anything. So you're bringing your pH down. There's a couple of different ways you can do that. And the most common way to do that is applying elemental sulfur. So elemental sulfur is very easy to find at most hardware stores, co-ops, It is just basically 90% to 100% pure sulfur. And so when you apply this, what happens in the soil is that the sulfur is converted into sulfuric acid, which will acidify the soil, obviously. It's got acid in its name. It is not converted into sulfuric acid in enough quantities to injure the plant. People think about sulfuric acid as, like, this really strong chemical, and in chemistry labs it is, but it's going to be rather dilute in the soil compared to what you would experience in a chem lab. So it's converted into sulfuric acid, and then it binds up with hydroxide ions. So basically, the sulfuric acid then loses its hydrogen because or loses a hydrogen, becomes less acidic that way, but that hydrogen ion bonds with the hydroxide to neutralize it. So that's how you, really, in any acidification technique, what you are trying to do in the soil chemistry is bind up the hydroxide so that there is less hydroxide in the soil. So elemental sulfur, usually the most common way to acidify the soil. You do have some other options. For example, applying a ammonium-based fertilizer like DAP or diammonium phosphate or monoammonium phosphate. The reason that ammonium acidifies the soil is the same as the sulfuric acid. It will donate a hydrogen atom to the hydroxide and neutralize it that way. When ammonium does that, it becomes ammonia, which is then converted into nitrate by soil and organisms, which the plant can then use. So you're getting a double benefit of adding nitrogen to the soil that the plant can use and bringing the soil pH down a little bit. I would say that that is good for minor pH adjustments, but if you are needing to, like if you are into vegetable production and you need to adjust the pH of your entire, you know, 5-acre plus field, it's going to quickly become cost prohibitive for major pH adjustments. So you could do a little bit with your nitrogen fertilizer, but you would need to probably also add elemental sulfur. Your last option for adjusting pH, and this is going to be the slowest method, but you do get other benefits from this as well, is to apply a acidifying organic matter source. It could be compost, could be peat moss, could be pine needles. So you would incorporate that into the soil that you're trying to grow in, and as it breaks down, it will slowly acidify the soil. And when I say slowly, I mean very slowly. You do have some methods to encourage a more consistent breakdown, like keeping the soil moist. Water will speed up the decay of the organic matter. Also, chopping the organic matter into smaller pieces, if you have pine needles, you want to make sure that that organic matter is very fine so that it takes less time for the soil organisms to break down. But you just incorporate that in. You're going to get benefits to your soil physical properties, like your soil texture and water holding capacity in addition to that. But that is going to be the least effective at changing your pH. One thing to keep in mind when you are changing your pH or when you are trying to adjust the pH of your soil is that clay is going to be very resistant to soil pH change. And that's because clay particles are negatively charged, so they are going to attract a lot of the hydrogen ions that you need in the soil, free in the soil, in order to have a more acidic soil. So for clay, when you are applying elemental sulfur, it's going to take about twice as much elemental sulfur as you would need for a loam soil in order to experience the same pH change. So that is definitely something to know before going to apply your soil amendment. Soil texture is pretty tricky, but usually when you have a lot of clay, you're going to see it be very sticky and pretty red or a pretty light color. The more loamy your soil is, the more dark and organic matter filled it's going to be. But if you are curious about what your soil pH and nutrient levels are, the Extension Office does all kinds of tests on the soil in order to make sure that you're not trying to apply something that you don't need to apply.
Gotcha. So
that's,
yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, that's a basic crash course in soil chemistry. It sometimes can get pretty technical, but this specific topic is one of the reasons why I think soil is such a fun thing to learn about, because a lot of people think about it as, you know, it's just dirt. But there's so many things that go into a healthy soil. You've got the soil biology, you know, like bugs and things that live in the soil. You got microbiology, bacteria. You got chemistry, which is what we're talking about right now. You got physics, which is like water movement through the soil and things like that. There's so many different facets of the soil that you can learn about in order to make sure that you are growing your plants as successfully as possible.
Well, yeah, and it is really interesting, and there is a lot that goes into that, like you said. And as we are getting into kind of that fall season and people thinking about, you know, taking care of their lawns and all that sort of thing, I know you touched on it a little bit, but is there any other things that we should be doing as far as maybe kind of like fall lawn care that we might want to do that kind of specific to this time of year?
Yeah, so if you are needing to seed your lawn for fescue, this is the time to do it too, either overseeding or just planting a new lawn entirely. There are different techniques depending on whether or not you're trying to establish a new lawn or just filling in some bare spots. But this is the time to be doing that as well. Basically, anything fescue related should be done right now. Outside of aeration, which is typically done in the spring. So fertilizing a lawn, we're getting a lot of soil samples in right now for determining exactly what the nitrogen level is. If you've had a soil sample done before and you know that your nutrient levels are where they should be, what we recommend is just adding 1 pound of actual nitrogen per 1,000 square feet. So that's going to be 10 pounds of 10, 10, 10, or 13, or sorry, not 13 pounds, yeah. So 10 pounds of 10, 10, 10 as an example. Because the fertilizer is 10% nitrogen, 10 pounds of 10, 10, 10 is going to be 1 pound of actual nitrogen. And you just apply that to your lawn pretty much every year once you know that your nutrient levels are where they need to be. That's going to add enough nitrogen for the next year for the grass without over-fertilizing and potentially experiencing runoff or excess nitrogen.
So
the reason?
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I was just going to say, the reason that we fertilize with nitrogen in the fall for fescue instead of in the spring is because there are far fewer weeds that can use the nitrogen in the fall. The tall fescue will be actively growing in the fall because it is a cool season grass. So you're going to get a lot more benefit to your grass from the nitrogen in the fall compared to in the spring when it's trying to compete with things like crabgrass and dandelion, chickweed and violet for that nutrient.
Well, and that makes sense.
That's the main reason why we fertilize now for nitrogen instead of.
Yeah, I've always kind of wondered about that, and that does make sense. And, you know, it just like anything, when you're dealing with soil, this is going to be one of those things where you're going to have to constantly, you know, at least once a year, be amending the soil just because, you know, the nitrogen's not going to last in the soil forever. And, you know, depending on your soil chemistry and all that sort of thing, you're going to have to keep up with it. It's not a one-and-done thing, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And actually, we can talk about that in the back half of the show. I think I'm on at the back half too. We can talk about how nutrients interact with the soil a little bit and kind of give the public an idea of what nutrients might run through the soil and need to be reapplied constantly and what nutrients will stick around in the soil because of their specific charge. Because that actually impacts your soil texture, how much clay you have, will impact how your nutrients stay in the soil profile. or how they move through it, depending on their charge.
Okay, sounds good. Well, we will do that here next, and maybe one of these days I'll get you to talk about pecans. I don't know if you will or not.
We can talk about pecans a little bit.
Okay.
Because I'm sure that topic is not, or the nutrients moving through the soil is not going to take up the entire.
Okay, that sounds good. We'll hold you to it there. So that's coming up next. We have 59 degrees in Coffeyville as we get ready for the news. And like I said, Jesse Gilmore will be coming back here in just a couple of moments with more here from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. We're going to a high today right around 90 degrees. And I know, yeah, awfully hot for this time of year. 59 right now in Coffeyville. Good morning, 8:11. We are back here on the Mighty 690 with folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. Joining us once again on the phone, we have horticulture agent Jesse Gilmore. Good morning once again, Jesse.
Good morning.
Alrighty, so we are kind of continuing from our last segment here. We wanted to talk a bit about how soil nutrients kind of move through the soil. Because, I mean, there's a lot going on. It's not just a static lump of clay, right?
Yes. So the charges of the different nutrients matter a lot when you're determining how they will move through the profile. So when you're dealing with nutrients, there's 17 nutrients that plants need. And a nutrient is just defined as something that an organism cannot metabolize on its own. So you can't, for example, calcium. For people, you can't make calcium inside your body, so you need to find calcium from an external food source in order to ingest the calcium and metabolize the calcium into your body. That's what a nutrient is. There are 17 of them for plants. 6 of them are primary macronutrients. That's going to be your hydrogen, your carbon, and your oxygen, your nitrogen, your phosphorus, and your potassium. Hydrogen, carbon, and oxygen are obtained through water absorption and gas inhalation for photosynthesis. So the gas flows into the plant through the stomata in the leaves, and then it is reduced into oxygen. So carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen you will not need to add to your plants at all because it gets that from water and air. Nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium you will need to add to the soil. What is interesting about nitrogen is that there's a couple of different forms you can add nitrogen in to the soil, which will then be converted into nitrate. Plants can only use nitrate, or NO3, when they are absorbing nitrogen from the soil. But for certain fertilizers, like we talked about in the first half, there's ammonium or ammonia-based fertilizers that will have NH4 or NH3, respectively. The plant cannot take up ammonium or ammonia, but there are bacteria in the soil, and with the help of some specific enzymes, they will convert ammonium and ammonia into nitrate for the plant to use. The thing about applying ammonia, especially during the hotter months, is that it is a volatile gas. So it can evaporate out of the soil if it is not incorporated deep enough into the soil, and you would experience nitrogen loss from the soil that way. So you wouldn't get as effective of a fertilizer application in the hotter months. But in the cooler months, when it can't volatilize out of the soil, it is a good way, like we mentioned previously, to get a little bit of soil acidification done too, in addition to your nitrogen application. Then you've got phosphorus. Phosphorus is responsible mostly for rooting and fruiting. So if you're growing things like tomatoes, peppers, it's going to be a very important nutrient to make sure your soil has enough of. We kind of run the gambit in phosphorus, whether or not we have enough or we don't have enough. Phosphorus is negatively charged, and going back to the nitrogen as well, nitrate is negatively charged, but ammonium is positively charged, and ammonia is neutral. So if your soil is high in clay, remember that the surface of clay particles is negative, which means that if you have a positively charged nutrient, it is going to be held in the soil by those negatively charged clay particles instead of running through. Negative does not bind to negative, so if you are applying nitrate, the soil is not going to hold the nitrate in the profile as easily. That's what we call a mobile nutrient in the soil. So with enough rain, water is going to carry the nitrate down lower into the soil profile where the plant roots can't reach. So you are going to need to be pretty consistent with your nitrogen fertilization every year. For nutrients like potassium in higher clay soils, potassium is a positively charged ion, so it is going to bond to those clay particles and be available for the roots a lot longer. It's not going to get washed out by rains and irrigation like nitrate and phosphorus will. So understanding the chemical form of the fertilizer that you are applying is very important. It also gives insight into why certain micronutrients might become deficient to the plant at certain pHs. So magnesium and iron, those are positively charged. The problem with that is that while they will bond to clay particles, they will also bond to hydroxide. So the hydroxide comes in and bonds to the positively charged magnesium or iron. And when the micronutrients are not ionic or charged particles, they can't be taken up by the plant. So you've got a neutral magnesium hydroxide ion in the soil. If that happens to enough of the magnesium in the soil, your plant might not be able to take up enough magnesium. You might start showing magnesium deficiency symptoms on the plant. That's not necessarily because the magnesium or the iron is not in the soil. It's just in a form that the plant can't use it because of the bonding to other ions in the soil. So you would want to neutralize some of those hydroxide ions using the acidification techniques we talked about in the first half in order to make sure that the nutrients that your plant needs stay available in ionic form. So that's really a very, very quick crash course on soil fertility and how pH can impact the fertility and the nutrients that your plants need in order to stay healthy.
Hey, well, that is some good information for folks to know. I mean, especially that knowledge is definitely power on that. And just switching gears a little bit, Jesse, I've been hounding you for weeks about the pecans and nut trees in southeast Kansas. So if you could just maybe touch a little bit on, as I see all these pecan trees that are like loaded down, what do we need to know for folks who might want to be able to harvest some of those as we get closer? What should we know?
Yeah, harvesting is not that complicated. Basically, unless you are the commercial producer of the pecans, just going to be harvesting them off of the ground. If you do have a commercial orchard for pecans, typically you're going to have equipment to shake the trees and then just have tarps or some similar like netting under the tree in order to catch all of the pecans that fall off of the tree. Pecans are in the hickory family. They are probably the most economically important of the hickory species because pecans fetch a strong premium in commercial markets and restaurants and things like that. People love pecans and are willing to pay quite a bit for them. So you got your trees, or you are thinking about getting pecan trees. The things that you need to look at for pecan trees are the specific variety that you want and its alternate bearing index, or ABI value. Pecans, like most other nut trees, go through what's known as mast years and off years. So as a survival tactic, in order to guarantee that at least some of the seeds become new trees, nut trees will overload their branches 1 year with so many nuts that the idea is that predators, like squirrels, for example, they are not going to be able to eat all of the nuts because there's just too many of them on the tree. So some drop, they reproduce, they, you know, germinate in the soil, and you've got a new tree, basically. The problem is that trees can't do that every year, or they would quickly starve themselves of resources. So every other year, you've got an off year compared to the mast year. And that off year, you might get some production, but you should definitely not expect as many nuts as in really good years. The ABI will tell you the likelihood of getting pretty much nothing from the tree. So the closer that the ABI is to one for that specific variety, the fewer nuts you can expect in off years. That's pretty important for people who are trying to grow commercially and want consistent nuts. It's not as important for the average homeowner. If people are interested in getting more information on pecans, I would 100% recommend Dr. Reed's Northern Pecan blog. He does a lot of research, and he did and still does a lot of research on different varieties, their shape, their color. I've had people ask me what variety of pecan they have on their property, and that is, to my knowledge, the only visual resource I've been able to find comparing the color and size and shape of the different nut varieties that he's grown. So that is one very good resource for finding out information on specific varieties. I wish I had written down the varieties that I liked the most when we were touring the pecan grove just south of Erie for a fall forestry field day. Now, that was about a year ago now with the Kansas Forest Service. Kansas Forest Service also has some pretty good information on pecans. But those are the two things that you really need to know. As you are growing pecan trees, they can get rather large, so without the machinery to harvest the pecans, to shake the pecans out of the tree, you are relying on them falling to the ground, and then shucking the holes if the holes remain on the nut, and then cracking the nuts or sewing the nuts whole to other people. You do want to make sure, if you are consuming the nuts, that you are making sure that you are not getting any nuts that have been infested by pecan weevils. So these are a tiny beetle species that will drill holes into the shell and lay eggs inside the nut meat. And that way, when the eggs hatch, the larva can just start eating the nut meat. And that's a good food source for them to survive. The way that you can tell, almost all of the time, it's going to have a hole somewhere in the shell. I am not 100% sure. Intuitively, this should work, but it doesn't always. Floating pecans versus sinking pecans, if you put them in like a cup of water, if it's got the hole in it, obviously the water is going to intrude into the shell and sink the nut that way. That way you would be able to tell at least some of the ones that have the weevil problem and ones that you would probably not want to. Other than that, other problems you might run into with pecan trees. Pecans are one of the few plants that I have in my sphere that suffer from boron deficiency. So going back to the nutrient management that we talked about just a little bit ago, boron is one of those micronutrients that is positively charged. So in high pH, you can see boron deficiency. That is something that you would actually need to spray on the leaf in order for the plant to take it up as quickly as possible, because soil cycling of boron is a little bit different from the other micronutrients. But the pecan weevil, one thing to know about pecan trees is that they are notorious limb droppers. So it's not something you would necessarily want to plant close to frequented areas or buildings, because those limbs, and when we're talking limbs, we're talking more like twigs, but sometimes limbs can drop as well. You want to make sure they're not dropping on anything valuable like cars or sheds or houses or people.
Sure.
There's a saying that the best pecan is in your neighbor's yard, because you get the benefit of the nuts with none of the cleanup.
Right. Yeah, but they do have a tendency to drop some of those. Now, I know there are those pecan crackers out there. You know, they actually, like, split them open. But is there anything special to get those holes off?
Not to my knowledge, and probably none that would be as effective as your hands, or as time effective as your hands. I'm sure there are products you can use. I've never heard of anyone using them. Typically, when you're harvesting pecans from a more individual standpoint, the hulling is, in my experience, according to other people, part of the fun. It's part of the real pecan experience. It is very labor-intensive and sometimes a pain, but I don't know of any products that would do it better.
Sure.
Ideally, the pecan nut and the shell will come out of the hole off of the tree with no need to hull it on your part. The only reason why holes would persist on the shell as they fall off of the tree is because of water issues. Typically, high humidity is going to make the holes stick to the shell. If we get really dry summers, like we have the last couple of years, that should not be an issue. The shell should just come right out of the hole, and the hole should actually remain on the branch as the nut falls to the ground.
Okay, good to know. And yeah, obviously that's not going to happen until everything is all ripe.
Yes, yeah. Pecans are very, very thirsty plants. So without enough water at very specific points in the nut's development, you're going to get very underdeveloped nuts and very few nuts compared to what you would be getting. So putting pecans in a low area where water can kind of pool or where water really persists during rain is important. They don't hate wet feet. They are not obviously going to want to sit in standing water 24/7 for like 5 days or so, but they can tolerate wet feet a little better than most other food producing plants can.
Gotcha.
Without that water source during the summer, usually around the middle of July, end of July, you're going to get a very low harvest of nuts. So some irrigation will be necessary. I believe, I don't have a specific number of gallons that you need to add to the tree, because that's going to vary based on how old the tree is, you know, the variety. One time I was asked by an insurance adjuster to estimate the pecan loss, like crop insurance. So this was a commercial producer who had lost a significant proportion of his pecan harvest due to drought. And I was asked to estimate the yield that the pecan harvester lost. And, like, they would determine the value from there. That took a lot of research into the amount of water that pecans need. The amount of water is not as important as the timing of the watering. You need a lot of water really early in the nut development. So timing is more important. It is ideal to give your pecan trees, just like any other tree, a good soaking every week or so. Because pecans are in the hickory family and are native to the southern U.S. and northern Mexico, they are going to be adapted to some amount of drought. For the people who really want those consistent harvests for pecans, some supplemental watering will be necessary.
All righty. Well, Jesse, I appreciate you expounding a little bit on that topic. And, of course, if people have any questions for you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Phone 620-724-8233 is the main office for me. Email also works, jr637@ksu.edu.
All righty, Jesse. Well, thank you so much for coming on the program today, and hope you get to feeling a little better and get on the mend, and look forward to chatting again here real soon.
That makes two of us. You have a good rest of the day.
All right. Thank you, Jesse. That is Jesse Gilmore from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. He's the horticulture agent. And coming up next, we have Open Line on the way here in just a couple of minutes. 62 degrees right now in Coffeyville.